Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Ever wonder what this thin layer of life is which grips the planet, rarely rising more than 10 feet, most confined to a few inches from the surface, some life reaching at its grandest a mere 300 feet off the surface of the Earth? It's a thin line we live in, and it got here somehow. It's a big debate, no doubt, even as we speak. And science seems to be central to the question and the controversy, and perhaps even the answer. When we return, we move along ahead a few billion years more and discover the shape of life in the universe. This journey continues when we return here on the Wildside News. What if Galileo had looked at everything differently? Would we be in the fix we are today? We continue our discussion with evolutionary biologist Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, who hand carries us farther into the mystery.
It's interesting, the Eastern and Western, that is part of the challenge these days, because the Eastern typically really has a focus on the One. The oneness, oftentimes, I mean, if people, for example, are meditating, they're thinking of oneness, the word Om is a process of trying to resonate with the One. And the Western tradition is one about me and individuation. And so those two are, all by themselves, sort of, they're different forms of being human, different approaches and views. But this is also part of our challenge right now, is trying to figure out how it is that we, because the West celebrates me.
Yes.
And the East, they focus on the oneness.
Yes.
How do we bring
that
together?
Rather than on the individuation. We
exactly.
In the West have taken the concept of the individual pretty far. And that's been an important process. In my universe, anything that can happen will happen. And somebody somewhere had to try out what it would be like to pretend you were separate from that oneness. And forgot, you know, that you were part of it, and how would that play out in society? And that's really what we've done. And now we find that there's this hunger for reintegrating the two paths of knowledge again to get a more complete view of things.
You made a point during your discussion that I found so enlightening, and that was the fact that the analogy that you draw is that Galileo had the opportunity to look both through a telescope and a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think this is so, I love this. And somehow the power of the celestial story, the astronomical vision of the world, overpowered what he could have focused on had he decided that the microscopic, or the living, was the main theme. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, yes. The heavens in Galileo's time had already been identified as celestial mechanics, and therefore it was compatible with this non-living universe story. And what I was saying was, if he had looked through those newfangled lenses of his day, inverted to make a microscope, he would have seen all those squiggly little things everybody has witnessed in that drop of pond water experiment or hay infusion experiment that you generally do in junior high school. And that was a miraculous world to study, just, and still is. That micro world is even more interesting now than it was then. And we're learning more about its unbelievable complexity. So it might have inspired Galileo to think more in terms of a universe of life, a living universe. That was what I had in mind there.
Well, and think about the changes. Had that been the main thrust of science, because both of these are science.
Then physics would have had to fit itself into the biology model. And that's exactly where I've come, is that if instead of, if you can make the unproven assumption that this is a non-living universe, and then do research within that framework and see how far you get, you can just as validly make the fundamental assumption and make it explicitly so that you're not hiding this, that you're working with a living universe, one that starts in consciousness, something none of us humans have ever been out of, so in some sense it must be fundamental in our models, and then go from there and see how do we reinterpret the data of all the research of science within that framework. Does it lead to better explanations of who we are and where we're headed? And I find that in my experience it does work better to make that assumption.
If we had spent the last 2,000 years focused from that perspective, what a different world the West would...
Yes, the problem with Western science is that you go to graduate school and you learn these unproven assumptions, these fundamentals in the model, but then people forget and they assume that, of course, this is a non-living universe. That's just the way things are. They don't realize that that is a belief that was set at the base of science. And let me just say that, you know, Descartes, who is one of the founding fathers of science, had a model of the universe in which God was the grand engineer who invented the machinery of nature. And then he put a piece of God mind into man, his favorite robot, so that man too could create machinery. Now, that was a logically complete system because machinery, if you look in a dictionary, requires an inventor. But scientists eventually decided that they had no need for this hypothesis of God and then continued to explain nature as machinery, which became completely illogical because you can't have machinery without an inventor, without any purpose. And science claims that there's no purpose and no inventor for the machinery of nature. So that's actually an illogical position.
As a scientist, I'm trained as a biologist. I have had experiences that lead me to understand, for example, that I can communicate with animals, that animals have a consciousness, they have an awareness, they have feelings, that they're way more complex than science allows us to even think. I mean, for example, I think the first commandment of science is thou shalt not anthropomorphize. Yeah.
Now, but interestingly, you are expected to mechanomorphize. In other words, you have to see nature as mechanics in graduate school as a biologist,
that's
right?
Exactly.
And
the point,
I used
yes.
to say, hey, mechanomorphism is secondhand anthropomorphism. Why not at least go directly to, I read a wonderful essay once with the statement in it that said it takes a living system to know a living system. So anthropomorphizing may not be all bad if you want to identify with life.
Let's have a little bit of fun for a moment here, and now let's go through the other system, because you have also really tracked the miraculous universe of the microscopic, and you're able to describe that miraculous nature in ways that I think are so profound. Share some of that, the concept of what's involved in even one living cell and how that cell then starts to relate to a more holistic vision of life and the earth and our place in that.
Yes, well, if I go for a minute back to the idea of the balance between entropy and centropy, or syntropy biologically, a planet's surface is really, as the ancients intuited, halfway between the microcosm and the macrocosm. That's now measurable. That's an established fact in science. And the way I see it, the entire universe is in the process of creating living systems at all levels, from particles and atoms at the small size level to superclusters of galaxies at the larger level up to the universe. And with the entropy-centropy concept, you find that actually there are only two cosmic forces, because the strong and weak nuclear forces are accounted for mathematically by gravity at the level of the atom, and there's no need for dark matter or energy to be postulated. Again, this is the theory of Nassim Haramein and Elizabeth Rauscher, whom perhaps you'll be able to interview sometime.
Great.
And in that system, I use the definition of life, which we've had now for about 30 years, from two Chilean-born biologists named Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. They were at MIT and the University of Paris, respectively. And that life definition is autopoiesis. It's the only core definition of life in biology. Usually people are just taught lists of attributes of living systems. Now, that definition is, autopoiesis is a Greek word meaning self-creation. And the definition of life, then, is any living entity is one that continually creates and maintains itself in an environment of some kind. So I thought about what would be the simplest thing that continually creates itself in relation to its environment, and I came up with a whirlpool, because a whirlpool in a river keeps bringing new matter energy, the water, the flowing water, into itself and lets that water out through the bottom, the tip of the vortex, and holds its form through that continual exchange of matter. Which is exactly what you and I do as physical bodies. We take in food, water, and air. We continually recreate ourselves from the particle and atom level up to the molecular and cell level, and we hold that form recognizably as we do so. So you see a connection between those two forms. Also, if you take the bottom of a vortex and connect it back to the top, and then flip it around into three dimensions, you get a donut shape, or a toroid. In mathematics, it's called a torus, a toroidal form. So a toroidal form is a vortex connected at top and bottom so that it can independently exist in space. Now, you and I are both toroids because we have one hole starting with our mouths that goes right through the middle of us, and if you know anything about the math called topology, you'll know immediately that that means our whole body is equivalent topologically to a donut-shaped torus. So all this led me to think, perhaps in this universe where you have infinitely outward entropy and infinitely inward centropy, halfway between the microcosm and the macrocosm on planets, you will find the forces of creation moving both upward and downward colliding at this mid-level of the universe, and they're forming the extra complexity we know as biological life. Mm. So this is my theory, that biological entities are nothing more nor less than a special case of the self-creation of living systems at all levels of our universe. That was a bit long, but I had to do that to get this out.
Well, I appreciate that. As I'm sure everybody is aware, this is an amazing discussion with an amazing person. I wish that we could go on for about 4 hours. We'll continue, but there's so much to this. And by the way, at this point, why don't you go ahead and give a website where people can learn more about your work, and okay, then we'll continue.
I have two websites. One is www.saturis.com, and that's spelled S-A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S, saturis.com. And that's kind of a business brochure with some links to articles, but most of my writings are on another website, which is www.radical, like radical with a T, RATICAL.org/lifeweb, LIFEWEB.
And, of course, those links are on the website.
Yes, and there's a whole copy of my book, Earth Dance, at that latter website, as well as about 20 or 30 articles. They're all free for the download.
Yes, which is a terrific gift to anyone who's listening. You can go there and literally download a 232-page book, Earth Dance, that Elizabeth Saturis has written, and it's yours as a gift. So it is truly a gift. Following on some of this concept, and one of the things that I've always been intrigued with as well, and I love the concepts of spirals. People talk about waves, for example, and they draw them on a chalkboard, these undulating lines. But from my perspective, a wave really is a cross-section of a spiral, that if you were to take a spiral and do a cross-section, that's what you'd see. And suddenly when you start to see waves or interpret them as spirals, then all of a sudden everything starts to make sense.
Yes.
When we talk about waves, because then they have energy, they have direction, they have form, they have power, and can take literally form and dimension. That manifestation in nature itself, for example, if we look at the DNA, just as one prime example of a couple of intertwining spirals that counter-reflect one another in many wonderful ways, that also is a manifestation of these of the duality of our nature in form. And I want to lead that to something else, but I'd just be curious of your comments about even DNA and its place in this story.
Well, I certainly agree with you that the spiraling form, you know, that that's the basic wave nature of the universe. If you think about, you know, our planet, it's not really rotating around the sun in circles because the sun is moving in spirals around in the galaxy, and then our Earth is following it around. So if you traced out the actual path of our Earth, it would be very complex spirals within spirals within spirals.
Exactly right, yeah.
Depending on whether you're looking at the Earth or the Sun or the galaxy, all of which are linked. You know, the old concept of it's turtles all the way down in the creation story of the Indians, who said the Earth is on a turtle's back, and where is the turtle? It's on another turtle's back, right? Well, spirals all the way down and all the way up in our universe.
One of the things I'm intrigued with when you talk about this concept, it's almost as if consciousness somehow is interwoven in this entire matrix.
Well, I think consciousness is the matrix.
Well, we're making the same point.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find so amazing in terms of the miraculous nature of life itself, and that is that no matter how complex our life becomes, somehow within this ancient DNA that was formed, you know, the basis of a human existence was mm-hmm. formed millions of years ago.
Yes.
So, and we see some sort of evolutionary process.
Billions, actually.
Well, I'm trying to be conservative, okay? But you're right. That within that DNA matrix was the power to envision beyond reality. That's one of the things that I just find is extraordinary. That there was some sort of survival advantage, some selective force for life that could literally see things that weren't. We look at our world today and we're still inventing new concepts, new things, new ideas. Even as we're talking, we're creating things that never existed before.
Yes.
And that built into our DNA as some sort of ancient system of survival was this capacity to see or envision or visualize answers to questions that were beyond our current realms.
I'm not exactly clear on how to talk about that in DNA separate from the proteins. Once again, we have a duality in nature. DNA by itself can't do anything. It's a crystalline substance, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And proteins are what unlock DNA as needed. So I've come to see DNA, which is housed in the nucleus of each of our 100 billion cells, as the library of information that proteins can draw on in building living systems. And it still isn't known how much of what goes on in our biology is due to the information in the DNA and what's due to the intelligence in the protein itself. So it's very hard to separate those two. But together, they certainly are building living entities which have a new kind of mind in evolution, this self-reflexive mind that, for example, invents a linear time sequence out of a nonlinear reality, so that we can function with memory of past and projection into future. And that's a wonderful new experiment on the part of nature, apparently. And we don't quite know what the results of that experiment are going to be. For example, I assumed, because we can project into the future, that we would be able to foresee where we're headed in the evolutionary trajectory and avoid some disasters, while the other species in nature have generally been pushed to evolve by disaster. But I have to say, Sydney, that the older I get and the more experience I have of my own species, the more it looks to me like we are being pushed by the crises we invent, just as other species have been pushed into evolution by crises.
I know. I think this would be a great point to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come back, I'd like to now explore how it is that these principles may be able to help us resolve our future in a better, more holistic, and sustainable way.
Okay.
So we are the stuff of the universe, and our thoughts and visions are like the movie screens of God, or perhaps they are just randomized ramblings of the atoms which interpenetrate them all. We interpenetrate our place on this earth and the cosmic dance, and what this may all mean to our future as oil prices hold guns to our dreams, and changes wrought by our great science and intellect sullied the vision of an endless carefree summer and beyond, when we return here on the Wild Side News.